Chapter 31. Gigi. My throbbing foot pulls me awake. An April rain streaks the window, and gray light barely makes it through. I watch my butterflies flap their orange and black wings inside the terrarium. I bet they're desperate for sunshine. Or maybe I am. I name them after the great ballet dancers. Martha, Gelsey, Mikhail, Svetlana, and Rudolph. My butterflies are the ballerinas of the animal world. Their movements light and peaceful and created by nature. I blink back the tears that keep coming in quiet moments when I'm alone. My pain meds knock me out and dull all the thoughts running through my head these days. But sometimes when I wake up in the morning, it all comes flooding back, like a big ocean wave threatening to swallow me whole. Did someone put the glass in my shoe on purpose? The angry truth. Yes. And why me? The most likely answer. Because I got Giselle. Other swirling thoughts. Because I'm new. Because I'm black. Because Alec and I are together. I remember the tears in Aunt Leah's eyes at the hospital when she saw my foot. My parents threatened to fly across the country, to come and take me home. I had no answers to their frantic questions. And now their questions have become mine. Each time they march through my head, I feel sick. My stomach twists in on itself, but my brain can't stop trying to piece it all together. The list of stuff is getting longer if I really look at it closely. I know Bet put the message on the mirror. She admitted to that. And putting up the picture of me and Henri in the light. But the pictures of her and Alec that were hung on my basement studio mirror, she refuses to own that. She's the only one who would have them. Does she expect me to believe that Alec did that? Or Eleanor? She didn't say she wrote that I should watch my back on the light wall, but it feels like her style. I don't know who sent that disgusting cookie, or who put the glass in my shoe, which I should be most worried about. But the medical file haunts me the most, even though it happened back in October. Someone saw my EKG report. They think I'm weak because of my condition. I wasted the day away in bed, my mind a fog of medications. I hobble around the room. Mostly everyone is spending their Thursday evening in the studios, doing homework, or making runs to the store. Even June's not around. I wish I could talk all this out with her. She's so logical. I bet she'd easily figure out who is doing this stuff to me. There has to be more than one person. It can't just all be Bet. I text Alec to see if he wants to hang out after his rehearsal. Then go down to the basement Pilates room to stretch, to make sure I'm staying strong. I'll be out of ballet class and rehearsal for at least a week, and we're 5 weeks away from the show. All the last-minute corrections and stage direction changes I won't get to actually do. I'll have to watch them. The room's full of mirrors and squishy bouncy balls and purple and blue mats and a few weight machines. It's empty. I get myself situated on a machine, the same way the physical therapist showed me. I lie on my back, sinking down onto the cushions. I put both feet on the foot bar, even though I shouldn't put pressure on my injured foot yet, and I push. The steel carriage under me slides up and down with the promise of helping me keep the strength in my muscles. After 5 minutes on the machine, I can feel the stitches in my foot and pain shoots up my leg. "Should you be doing that yet?" a voice says. I crane my head and see Will standing in the doorway, all sweaty with a towel across his shoulders. "No," I say, "but try a few more pushes." He stands over me and extends his hand like we're on stage and ready to start a pas de deux. I stop, sit up and take it. "You could mess up your foot even more," he says. "You sound like one of our teachers," I say. "Or even my mama." "Good." He sits on the mat and starts stretching. "So what can you do? What did they say?" "Stretch and light weights and floor bar. So basically nothing. His eyebrows lift in that pitying way. Can we talk about something else? I say, tottering over to get weights from a corner rack. He runs ahead of me and carries them back. I grumble at him, but eventually smile and say thanks. We sit on the floor together. So, I shouldn't ask you if they figured out who put that glass in your shoe, he says. Not unless you already know, I say back. I don't. I'd usually blame Bet, he says, rolling his eyes. But I'm not so sure this time. She definitely has it in her. Seriously. Don't buy into the stuff Alec tells you about her. She's got him fooled, and everyone else. His eyes get all big, like he's scared of what he's saying. She put a lot of people through shit. If it was her, she deserves to get what's coming to her. He inspects my foot. You should be careful with her. His words mimic what Henri told me at the beginning of the fall term, and in the notes he keeps sending me, and that stupid Valentine's message. I don't want to talk about it. And you told me that before. Especially not with him. How are things with you? I ask, for lack of anything else better. Really good. He gushes in a way I've never seen before, then leans in. I might have my first ever boyfriend soon. That's news to me, but I try to keep the surprise off my face. Oh, really? I say. Do I know him? A dancer? Maybe, is all he says. Tall, dark, and handsome. It's so hard to meet people outside the ballet world. Spending your time in and out of studios, at rehearsals, stretching, and fretting about every little motion of a variation doesn't leave much room for anything else. The prom and homecoming invites come, and are left unanswered or declined, and they eventually stop coming. It's easier to date someone inside ballet. Details? A kiss? Hanging out? I parrot Mama when she's poking Aunt Leah about her dating life. I'll never tell, he says, a blush making his face match his hair. Well, at least not yet. He's kind of shy. Anyway, so what's the prognosis on your foot? Wait a minute. I turn to look at him, giving my best spill it face. You're not getting off that easy. Well, let's just say he's really hot. Will smirks and is about to say more. But Alex steps into the doorway, and all of Will's excitement and laughter zips right up, like a bag that's closed. He clears his throat and pretends to smooth his perfect hair in the mirror. Hey, I say to Alec, and he steps into the room like it's full of landmines. They don't speak, and I'm not sure what's happened.
Chapter 32. Bet. For the first time in my life, no one's listening to me. Even Eleanor has started putting in her earbuds and humming along with the Giselle music when I start talking about Gigi and Alec, and Gigi's obsession with stealing everything from me, and Gigi's obvious psychotic breakdown after her incident with the cookie. But today, I pull her earbuds out while we're getting ready for morning ballet class. Are you listening to me? I'm trying to focus, she says. And it's kind of like you have an obsession. No, I don't, I say back. Then why do you keep talking about her? Just trying to loop you in. I feel like she just spit in my face. She starts to put her earbuds back in. I don't know if I want to be looped in anymore, she says. But I run right over all those words and keep talking. I even talked to June about it. We both think Gigi and Mr. K are having an affair. That's the way she got both of these roles. Eleanor's hand freezes beside her ear before she can jam the earbud in. I kind of threw myself at him too, a few weeks ago, I admit, wanting my best friend back, wanting to be able to share everything again, no matter what, just to see. She turns red, and not the pretty flush you get after a long ballet class. It's the kind you get when you've fallen down a flight of stairs with everybody watching, or discovered you have a booger in your nose while talking to someone you like. "Why would you do that?" she says. "I thought I could get my roll back." I start gathering my hair up into a bun. "It's not like that hasn't worked before," Adele told me. "He doesn't go around randomly hooking up with his dancers," she says, her tone snappy. "Don't you think he's too smart for that? He could get in trouble." Adele says, "I don't want to hear about it." She gets up and grabs her dance bag. "I need to get ready for class." I take a pill to try to erase those thoughts and the embarrassment of having my own best friend walk out on me. I try not to think about how many pills I've taken, or the fact that in the last few months, I've almost doubled the amount. Instead, I slick down every piece of hair, making sure it's perfect, and go downstairs for ballet class. I dodge Henri's gaze as I slip into Studio C, suppressing memories of skin on skin, his lips on mine. I keep to myself. The girls are watching. Gigi is sitting in the front, her swaddled foot perched on a pillow on a chair, like it's a glass slipper. I dance harder now that she has to watch from the sidelines. I hope she feels like I did when I had to watch her dance the Sugar Plum Fairy, or watch Cassie dance the Fairy Spirit. Ballet class ends, and Mr. K visits to tell us that tonight's rehearsal is canceled. It's Alex's father's birthday party. All the teachers are attending, and the board members, and other important people in the city who love ballet. My mother is pulling me out of afternoon academic classes so I can get my hair blown out and a new dress. She thinks I need to win Alec back. She thinks I'm a mess. Maybe she's right. I stay after everyone's left the studio to stretch a bit longer. My knee doesn't hurt as much when I cool down longer. Other dancers head off to lunch and afternoon academic classes. It always amazes me how sudden the transformation is, from chaos to stillness, from suffocation to solitude. I never thought I'd ever want to be alone. The studio door opens, not with a creak or a knock, but with a bang and a breeze. Someone who knows I'm in here and who doesn't give a shit about startling me or interrupting my stretching. Mr. K is back. "Just the girl I was looking for," he says. The words give me a shiver. They twinkle with his threat of calling my mother and setting up an appointment with the school psychologist. "Hey there," I say, trying to sound casual, standing up, even though the pain in my knee screeches a little. "I just need a few Advil and maybe a secret trip to the physical therapist. Then I'll be fine." "Morky's been pleased with your work the last week," he says. His words have weight. What he means is that I was blowing it for a while, and now I am finally clawing my way out of the hole. I nod my head because, really, it's not exactly a compliment. And we both know it. "You've been letting Gigi get the best of you," he goes on. "You can't always be on top at every single moment. But you can still be great." "Or I can be the best," I say. "You spend much time with her?" Mr. K says after clearing his throat. He's not one for small talk, so the casual tone sounds forced. "She's been having a rough go of it lately, as you know." "Gigi?" "Yes. Your competition? Are you listening?" "As much time as I spend with anyone. I can tell he needs me, but he's uncertain how to proceed. In some strange and unexpected way, I'm in charge. He knows I'm the heart of this school. I know what's really going on with his dancers." "She ever mention any rumors about who is behind all this nonsense? Have you heard any rumors? You know I don't like gossip to affect my dancers." Mr. K shifts his weight. I have never seen him standing in anything but a straight and perfect vertical line, But now he's leaning against the bar a little, like a regular man and not a great dancer. Not like the man who controls our futures, my future. He reaches out his hand to me. I take it, and he pulls me closer to the bar. Last time he withdrew, but this time his touch is warm, inviting. Like maybe things would be different if I just tried one more time. You look remarkably like your sister up close. He lifts my chin, his eyes climbing over my face and neck and even cleavage. All of a sudden, all I hear in my head is the conversation I just had with Eleanor about him. All I can think about is how Adele said she used to let Mr. K kiss her neck and run his fingers along the bottom edges of her leotard when he'd show her how to correctly let her paw partner lift her. God knows what else they've done together. I thought I was getting her back. With you coming up the ranks, I thought you'd dance more like her, he says, deadpan, with no regard for any feelings I might have about my sister. I don't blush often, and I can feel the disgusting red heat radiating from my face and the tears that usually come with it. I swallow it all down, packing it inside. I don't have time for rumors, I say, making my voice sound calm and unaffected. And I definitely don't have time for idle chatter about Adele, even if she was your favorite. Mr. K pulls his hand away from me, like I'm a piece of trash dropped in a basket. He clears his throat again. I wonder if maybe Gigi got the wrong impression. Sometimes you girls get quite confused, he says, after a pause that I think might swallow me whole. He's retreated, but he doesn't take his eyes off mine. Our eyes are the same, light blue and brimming with challenge. I can't let him dismiss me again, like he did in his office last week. The threat of the school psychologist still rings in my ears, and that same flush of embarrassment crawls up my skin. I don't reply. He rubs his hands together, like they are two sticks making a fire. Mr. K is so heated and so powerful. I wouldn't be surprised if flame sprung from his hands. I take a tiny step back. I really don't know, I say at last. I miss when his loaded statements had to do with his interest in me and my career, and not his worry about Gigi. I can ask around, I say. We both know it's a threat and not a favor. Mr. K shakes his head and leaves me standing there. As soon as he's out the door, I let out one raging scream into my ballet sweater. Alex's house looks like it always does, but gift-wrapped for his father's birthday party. A beautiful Upper East Side townhouse between Madison and Fifth Avenues. Even better than mine, though my mother would never admit it. But when we get to the door, Mr. Lucas hugs me with only one arm and doesn't kiss my cheek like he used to. His new wife's hand is so cold on my shoulder that I shiver, and Alex's sister Sophie, who used to beg me to do her makeup and help her with her pirouettes and sautés, barely musters the enthusiasm to wave in my direction. The parlor is filled with important dance types, milling around in their evening finery, most of them onto their third or fourth cocktail. None of the other students are here, not even Alex's precious Gigi. Most of us are not deemed important enough, unless there's a legacy, a family history at this school. Which I have, thanks to Adele, and my grandmother's money. Alex upstairs, Mr. Lucas says, before he leans in to embrace Adele and compliment her on her most recent performance. He even quotes a line from the New York Times review. His ridiculous wife laughs wildly, like Adele is a celebrity, which I guess for the ballet world people, she is. But I will be too, someday. And then they'll regret their cool treatment of me. Is he expecting me? I say. It doesn't sound right. The words formal and strange in my mouth. and their faces show as much discomfort as I'm feeling. I don't wait for an answer, just head up the stairs like it's every other Thanksgiving or Christmas or birthday celebration, even though now he loves someone else, and I'm all alone. His door is wide open, and I catch sight of him before he notices me in the frame. I never forgot how handsome he is, but he looks even better than the image in my head. Maybe it's seeing him in normal clothes instead of his practice clothes, but he's so boyish and beautiful and real. I almost can't breathe. When I do finally manage a breath, it turns almost immediately to tears. That's when he sees me. I try to make the tears silent ones, at least, since I can't seem to make them dry up. But I sniffle a few times, and then break down into full-on sobs. I haven't cried like this, loud and unforgiving, since the Christmas my father left, and the thought of that makes me cry more. Between my knee and the random April snow shower outside, and the sound of my reckless sobbing, I'm practically reliving those horrible days. Oh my God, what? What happened? Did your mom? Alec moves toward me, and I let him wrap me in a hug. I cry into his shoulder until his crisp, white dress shirt is soaked through in the shape of my eyes and mouth. He rubs my back and shushes me, his mouth next to my ear. One movement of his mouth, and he'd be kissing the lobe, working his way down my neck until we're making out on his bed. It's such a familiar routine. I'm surprised he doesn't do it just on reflex. Everything's wrong, I say at last. I whisper, but I probably don't have to. There are glasses clanging downstairs, and loud bursts of laughter, followed by a frantic mix of voices, everyone trying to talk over everyone else. Adele's voice coming out the clearest, getting the most space.
What did she do?
Alec says, still thinking this is all about my mother, when really, she's only a part of it. She's fine. She's been okay. Distracted by drinking.
Oh.
Don't you want me still? I press my body against his a little. He resists, but not so much that he pulls away.
I know you don't want to hear this, but I'm with G.
That's okay. It doesn't even have to be anything real. Don't you just want me, though? Like before? I won't tell, couldn't we?
I reach one hand around his neck and run one finger back and forth across the place where his hair meets his neck. He always liked that, and he shivers a little in response.
You know I'll always care. I know she's really inexperienced, I say. It's not planned. And it's not exactly the best argument to get what I want, when what I really want is Alec to love me again. But I'll take anything right now.
God, Bet, I miss you so much. You have to miss me a little. You don't do all that with someone and then just never think about it again.
I reach down to his pants, the waistband, and then the button, the zipper. He doesn't push my hand away. I expect to feel a rush of love, a kind of bliss that I can have him again, but instead, I can only think one terrible thought. I've got to find a way to let Gigi know about this. Then, as if he heard what was going on in my head, he jolts away from me.
Hey, no. I'm sorry, but no,
he says. His words are still nice. Maybe because his shirt is still wet with my tears, or maybe because I look so pathetic, all dolled up and limping and throwing myself at him. I don't say anything in response. There's nothing to say. He takes a few steps back and gives a sad little smile.
Why do you like her?
I ask. Because I'm nothing if not my mother's daughter, a glutton.
We shouldn't talk about this. He says, not right now.
No, tell me. I can take it, I say.
He sighs. I give him a small shove. I want to know. You owe that to me at least.
She's easy, he answers, and doesn't mean the kind that comes with random hookups. She makes me laugh and forget all the crazy stuff at school. Okay? I step back. We've been a mess for a while, Bet. We started doing our own things, he says. I put my hand up. Got it. Look, I'm going to go downstairs, he says, quickly swapping his tear-soaked shirt for a crisp new one. Cheese plate, say hi to your sister. You come down whenever you're ready, okay? I don't say anything. Okay. Hey, everything's gonna be okay. Then I'm alone in his bedroom, and it all looks just the same as it has for years, but different too, because he's not in it, and there are no photographs of us on his bulletin board, and the bed is perfectly made, instead of mussed up by our bodies rolling around on it. Then I notice it, a brown box marked with Gigi's name sitting on his desk, a little pile of origami roses next to it, a letter, some chocolates. I don't go for the letter, though a part of me aches to read it, to know what words he uses with her, how he tells her how beautiful she is, if he loves her. I finger the roses. I pick up the roses one by one. I wish I could stuff the box full of more of the photos of Alec and me. Whoever gave her those did me a favor. I wonder if he still has his copies. And I wonder if he even knows about her getting the pictures. I wonder why Gigi wouldn't have told him. I try to ignore a tiny whisper inside my chest. Maybe because she's better than you, Bet. To get rid of the thoughts, I ramble through his room and look for his copies of the pictures. Obviously, she hasn't gotten the message that Alec and I are meant to be. She needs to remember that Alec and Bet existed, that Alec and Bet meant something. I know he used to keep them in his closet, in a box within a box where he kept other private things, a few sad Playboy magazines, a letter from his real mother, whiskey bottles stolen from a hotel room, a photograph of his father as a younger man, and a gorgeous Asian dancer that has been folded and unfolded so many times, you just know it was in a wallet for years. And the pictures of me and Alec, together. They are mostly of me, though Alec's legs and hands and eyeline are sometimes in the frame. Alec took some of me on my own, naked and smirking at the camera. Then I convinced him to set the timer and get in the pictures with me. In one, my legs are wrapped around his waist and his face is buried in my neck. 2 years ago, when we were just moving from kissing and holding hands to taking off each other's clothes and touching what was underneath. But right under them is something even better. All the love letters we sent each other, bundled with twine like something out of a romance movie. When we were 14, he'd said we should make a time capsule and bury it near the tiny fountain in the backyard, something he'd seen on TV. He made me bring him all the letters he sent me, then put them together like puzzle pieces. I'd been stupid back then, told him it wasn't sexy, as if I really knew what that word meant. He stopped writing me letters after that. He won't miss them, I think. And then, I still know him best. And then, she would never do this. I choose the best letters, the ones where he tells me all the things he loves about me, the ones where he tells me we'll be together forever and get married, the ones where he tells me how beautiful I am. The rest of the night's not so bad. Alec keeps smiling his sad smile at me, and Mr. Lucas ignores me, and no one tells me how pretty I look or how great I was in rehearsal. But it's really not so bad, because I'm taking back control. When I get back to the dorms, I go to the light with the letters, paper, glue, and scissors, where I can be alone. I lock the door behind me. I cut out my favorite phrases from the letters, arranging them on the page and gluing them down. I ignore the thoughts cramming into my head. This is crazy. Only psychopaths do this. This is some serial killer type stuff. I imagine the look on her face when she sees what we had. What she will have to live up to. What she'll never be. The insecurities popping up inside her after I deliver these to her room. I'm not crazy, I say. Alec and I know everything about each other. We belong together. We have a history. We were meant to be.
Chapter 33, June. It's 3 o'clock on Sunday, and the bustling kitchen of Jehee's Elmhurst Queens restaurant, Che's Chum Chum, is crammed with people. Busboys, dishwashers, waiters, several cooks, and his dad, who's running the show. Jehee's in training to take over this branch, and even though he's not happy about it, he still seems pleased to show it off to me. And to show me off to his dad. Apparently. His dad hands me a series of tiny appetizer plates, brimming over with spinach salad, pickled radishes, bean sprouts, and more. The waiter behind me sets down others. Kimchi, crispy sweet potatoes, fried onion pancakes, dumplings. The porcelain dishes clink a melody along the table as they're arranged before us. My stomach balloons just looking at all this food. But my mouth waters. I want to eat it. And keep it down. Jehee's dad says something in Korean. I don't understand what he says, but I think I get what he means. Eat, he says to me in English, nodding toward the plate. Good for your ribs. He always pauses for me to respond, but I can't. I feel a stupid, lost-in-translation expression climb over my face. It's embarrassing. There's another flurry of too-fast Korean, but I understand the word harmony. Grandmother. I can see her small, wrinkled face and those warm eyes. I wish I could see Jehee's grandma again. It's been too long since someone's been that kind to me. Jehee and his dad fuss a little. Jehee's shaking his head and says no a bunch of times. His dad is distracted for a moment, giving one of the waiters a direction.
What's he saying?
I whisper to Jehee, feeling ridiculous that I can't fully understand my own language. Not important, he says, popping a potato into his mouth, which lets him get away with not answering me. But it is. He was talking about your grandmother and me. I heard him. I nudge his leg until he sighs. He said after we eat that I should take you to go see her, he says, dipping his chopsticks into another dish. You know we... He swallows the word can't along with the chipojorim, the fish jerky, strong and chewy in his mouth. I stir a spoon in my tofu soup. While he wants me here, he could never bring me that far back. Not without everyone knowing what we're doing. This all started out as a game, and now I'm here with his dad in one of their family restaurants. It hits me that this has become something so much more than what I thought. And it still has to be a secret. But I think maybe, when I go back to the dorms, the other Korean girls will know anyway. Because the scent of sesame oil pervades everything, and I know I'll go home smelling like it, sharp and pungent. His dad sets down more bowls and stares at me, waiting. I know he wants a little head nod, the approval that everything is so good. But it's hard to enjoy food anymore. I take a tentative bite of the hot pan-fried mandus and dip out more soup. Then, knowing what Jehee wants, take a big slurp. Jehee and his dad grin at each other. Then Mr. Che nods toward the kitchen door. Go, sit. Enjoy, he says, his dark eyes, the same as Jehee's, twinkling with delight.
Good appetite.
And he and Jehee exchange glances that I decipher easily. He's pleased that his son has found a girlfriend who actually eats. Not like Sejin. except that Jaehee is still with Seijin, and I'm just the old childhood pal. But Mr. Che knows what I do too, that Seijin will disappear, off to Harvard or Yale or wherever, and Jaehee will realize that he doesn't even miss her, that he never really loved her, that it was me all along. Yes, that must be it. I wait for Jaehee to ask me about Seijin's fall down the stairs, and if I pushed her. Bet covered it up with the other girls, spread a nasty rumor that Seijin slipped down the stairs and tried to pin it on me so she could get rid of me. Everyone always believes Bet. I grab one of the sticky ribs from the table, which is piled high with more food. Chicken wings and noodles and bibimbap in stone bowls. All the house specialties his dad insisted we try. Every time I blink, more hands deliver more food. I tear the meat off the bone with my teeth, feeling ferocious and fierce and strangely sexy as I feel Jaehee's eyes take me in. There's a pride and tenderness on his face that I haven't seen on anyone's in so long. Not when they look at me. Certainly not my mom's. But then he bursts out laughing.
You're the only girl I know who always manages to get food not just on her face, but in her hair, he says,
stroking my forehead as he pulls a chunk of barbecued meat from a strand. You're too light hair, he says, quiet and sweet. I push his hand away with my own.
You're getting sauce on my head,
I say, mock annoyed.
You already had sauce on your head,
he says, laughing.
And your hands, and your face.
He pokes me in the boob, a splotch landing on my baby pink cardigan.
And your chest, he says with a smirk. Eat fast, he says, his eyes hungry. We've got to get you back to the dorm.
I don't want to head back. I just want to stay here, in his world for a moment, away from the meanness of starving girls and the weight of always being second best. But as much as I like being here and seeing his dad, I know why he brought me to Elmhurst and not to Astoria, where his mom is in charge at their other restaurant, where his grandmother would see me and talk about the good old days, sighing over what was lost and how glad she was that I was found again. He can't let any of it get back to Seijin. He can't let her find out about me. I'm still a secret, and that stings. I know he wants me. I meant for this to be a simple game of vengeance, of finally getting what someone else wants. But now, Jaehee feels like the one thing I don't really have anymore. Home. These are the steps that no audience will ever see me dance. Sweeping arms, a deep arch in my back, and curling forward, drawing an invisible circle around myself. At times like this, my body and the music are one perfect unit. In the second half of the ballet, the character Giselle is a ghost. I have to be invisible inside the music, haunting the stage but not ever really inhabiting it. I know how to be invisible. As Gigi's understudy, I get to dance her part during our first weekly evening rehearsal. But it's the only time I'll get to dance it. Gigi has stage presence, large and unbreakable. She has charisma. She has that luminous quality that Mr. K is always going on and on about, and strong shoulders and a deep, warm smile when she dances. Still, Gigi could never do this as well as me. That's what makes her so wrong for this role and me so right. I am floating. It's been 3 days since being in Queens with Jaehee, and since then, I have eaten so little, purged so much, I can barely feel the weight of my own body as I stand on my toes. I can move so lightly, so effortlessly. I am barely here at all. No one really sees me. I'm used to being invisible. I almost lose concentration in my pirouette. I've lost count of the turns, 7, 8, maybe even 10. On that last precise spin, I see Gigi watching me, her mouth in a little O, her hand resting over her heart. I don't know if she is capable of feelings like resentment or bitterness, but if she were, this is what jealousy would look like on her. The top half of her body is even leaning back a little, like she's afraid of me, of my quiet power on stage. I complete the dance, arms so strong they could stay over my head into eternity. I do not move a muscle until long after the last note has faded. My muscles don't even twitch with effort. True to form, it is Gigi who claps first. I almost wish she didn't. I wish the perfection of me dancing her role would put a stop to her incessant kindness, that it would bring out something different in her, something darker. But Gigi claps, and the rest of the class follows. Morky, Victor, Bet even. The applause doesn't last long enough. Mr. K is in the door and scoffs, unimpressed by the applause, the sweat on my shoulders, the perfection of my 99 pounds.
Understudy still? Do this with them afterward. We must continue, Mr. K says to Morky. It'll be opening night before you know it. And where will we be?
Then he adds something in Russian. I don't think he even knows my name, though he's known me my entire life. Morky clears her throat and claps her hands, but this time as an order.
Of course, she says. Off, June.
I am not graceful, lifting myself up from the floor. What moments before felt beautiful and light and invisible now feels bony and awkward and empty.
Before we continue, Mr. K says,
letting his eyes meet each of ours briefly,
I don't want to forget to tell you that we've selected many of the Giselle variations to be a prominent part of the end-of-year exams.
The room goes still. These exams weed out those with shaky technique. They're graded just like a final, and if you don't pass, you might as well pack your bags.
I don't have to remind you that the end-of-year exams help us see your technical progress, and to think about whether you'll be apprenticed with the company, needing to work a little more, or find yourself a company member, he says.
On cue, I'm sweating and shaking, and I want to visit the bathroom to just expel all that fear in liquid form. I can't afford the nerves, not when I just completed the best dance of my life, not when I finally have the chance to show them my potential, not when I have to prove my mom wrong. Mr. K's shoes click and clack on the surface of the studio's floor, their echo commanding us to stay perfectly still. Mr. K passes by Bet, and he looks at her closely for a moment. A long, long moment.
You're tired, he says, squinting at her face.
She blushes and bows her head. Even the great and powerful Bet is whimpering in his presence.
I've been working hard, she says.
And to my surprise, her voice trembles. It's a sound I've never heard come out of her before. There's something weird about all the changes happening around here.
Show me, Mr. K says.
What?
Bet's voice goes even smaller, even shakier. It is a shiver.
Show me how hard you've been working.
Before, we were all still. Now, we are statues. Bet pulls a breath in. From where? I don't know. The room is closed. The air is trapped. We could all suffocate here and now. And then, Bet's dancing, slipping back and forth across the floor, shaking when she goes on point, losing balance when she lifts into an arabesque. She's Bathilde, the rich woman engaged to Albrecht, the man Giselle loves. The role is minuscule, but Morky has choreographed something just for her, something not in the original ballet. It's not bad. It's still technically lovely, and even has an elegant fluidity. But it's rocky, too. It's shaky. Just like the night when I helped her with her pirouettes. The technique is there, the beauty is there, but the control is gone. I've never seen her dance like this. Mr. K walks out without a word when the variation is over. I see Bet swallow, and Morky scramble, and we all move to the bar and pretend that didn't just happen.
Variations, Morky says,
and she goes to Bet. We're all meant to work on our own for a moment, making sure not to let our muscles cool off. Eleanor is at the bar, stretching across it, deep in some sort of chant. I hear her speak the words of her choreography one after another in a weird rhythm. Sejin prances over. Her presence is so big that I can feel her coming. She stands over me, hands on her hips.
I heard you're leaving, she says, giving a fake pout.
Her friends giggle. The sparkly excitement that had been building up in my chest congeals, goes hard and cold, and drops down into my stomach. Huh?
Yep. My mother told me you were leaving. Something about...
She pauses and puts a finger to her mouth.
Going to a normal school? 'Cause you can't land a lead role. Always the understudy.
I wring my warm-up sweater in my hands and think of my mom calling Mrs. Kwan to discuss pulling me out of the conservatory and if she's heard anything about PS525. My jaws clench and I feel my cheeks vibrate from the pressure. I feel the judgment in her eyes. I know what she's thinking. A real Korean ballerina never quits. They work and work and work until they are better than their counterparts, until they land that role no matter what. It's the Korean way. That much I've inherited. I'm not leaving, I say. Don't you worry. I make a kissy noise at her. Her face flames.
I wasn't. Just thought you should know what people were saying about you.
I'm just getting started here, I say, letting my voice rise. I don't care who hears it. You have no idea what's coming. I step in closer to Sejin so that she can smell how serious I am.
You don't intimidate anyone, Ijun, she says,
but she leans back on her heels, like she is, maybe, just the tiniest bit intimidated.
You may have shoved me down the stairs, but I'll get you back for that. I hate you.
That's when I almost tell Sejin's secret. I almost scream the word lesbian, wanting it to echo and bounce off the studio mirrors. But I can't. And one kiss doesn't make her that. And so what if it did? She's the one who's scared of that, not me. But for now, it's all I've got. So I have to save it for the right moment. For the moment when her mother can hear it. For the moment when even just saying the word, true or false, has the power to change something. I lean in close to her, feeling powerful. Are you sure about that? There was a time when you really liked me. Remember that? She races off, and her onlookers follow suit, just in time for Mr. K to return to the studio and call us around for closing rehearsal remarks. He yaps on about emotion and Giselle and ballet. Again. He waves us off. We curtsy and the teachers leave. I skip cooling down, even though it's horrible for my muscles, not wanting to stay around for the girls' nightly debrief of rehearsal. I don't want to hear them agree with Mr. K about the understudies not rehearsing. It's hard to sit and listen sometimes. The word understudy feels like the word loser. meaningless, invisible. I head to the student mailboxes near the front desk to pick up the dried soup I know my mother dropped off for me. I jam my key into my box, and the door creaks open. There are 3 packages of Korean noodles and an envelope. I don't ever receive mail. Not a letter, a postcard, or even a simple post-it note. And never anything from my mother aside from Korean food. In a secret and dark place inside me, I'm hoping it's from Jaehee. An anime sketch or a quick comic strip. It's stupid. I know this. I would laugh at anyone else who behaved this way. But I can't bury the feeling no matter how much I try, or tell myself it isn't real. My mind makes a simple envelope into the biggest thing that's ever happened to me. I wait until I'm in my room, alone, to open it. I carefully pull up the flap and unfold the paper. My eyes scan the typed words. My fingers start to sweat. The page slips from my hands, floating to the floor. It's my enrollment confirmation at PS525. It's my summer class schedule. It's the end of my life. I almost fall, my knees weak, my heart threatening to give out, my head full of heaviness. I vomit all over myself. I can't even move to the trash can. The sloppy, burning liquid spews out and down my black leotard, making a print of bile and half-digested grapefruit bits all over Madame Matvienko's white practice tutu. My hands can't hold it in my mouth. I drop to my knees. My eyes burn. My chest heaves. I think I might throw up forever. The door opens. It's Gigi.
Oh my God, June!
She rushes to my side with a trash can. The hiccuping makes my stomach muscle sore. Tears pour out and I can't stop them as she holds me over the metal bin and I empty my already empty stomach. The greasy Chinese food Gigi deposited in there yesterday makes me retch even more. She strokes my back in a pattern, almost like it's a song, until the heaving stops. I can't move my arms, and I feel like I'm sinking into the floor, straight down through it. All my energy's gone into that trash can. She wipes my face and chest and tutu with a towel. She plugs in my electric teapot while I sit in a crumpled heap. She returns with a steaming cup. She's made it the perfect Korean way, picking the barley out of one of my packs, boiling water in the pot, sprinkling the barley on top, letting it steep in the water without pushing it down. I didn't know she knew how I made it. She doesn't talk for a long time. As she refills the teacup, as she helps me undress, as she wipes more of the mess off me, as she tucks me into bed. Then finally, she asks, "What happened?" Her eyes are full of concern. Genuine concern, like she loves me. And then the tears pour out again because I've been horrible to her. I want to tell her I don't know how to be nice, that I've been mean for so long that it's all I know how to do. It's a reflex now, as natural as a plié. There are dark points inside me that I can't stop from coming out. Words spill out of me like more vomit. I tell her about the public school, about not knowing who my father is, and worst of all, about pushing Seijin. Her eyes grow big and her mouth purses, but she doesn't move from my bedside. Her nose doesn't crinkle with judgment. She just tells me everything is going to be okay and strokes the top of my head until I am drowsy from all the puking and talking and emotions. I drift off a little, still in and out of sleep. My head pounding from too many tears, and my throat raw from too much purging. At last, the room light clicks off. Gigi lights one of her scented candles, and I'm too tired to tell her to blow it out, that it stinks and gives me a headache. And she was so nice to me. I shouldn't even think this way. The door creaks open, and I hear Alex's husky voice and feel him pass by my bed. I roll over, hating the fact that tonight, of all nights, she let him come over. I ignore the pinch of wishing Jaehee were here to take care of me.
June's in bed so early,
I hear Alec whisper. The bass in his voice ripples through the room.
And it smells in here.
Yeah, poor thing. She had a rough night,
Gigi whispers. I freeze. My weak hands clutch my comforter until my knuckles are white. I wait for her to tell him that I vomited all over myself, like I'm a 2-year-old with a tummy ache. But she doesn't. She keeps my secrets. It's then that I realize that, as much as I may look at her as the one who takes everything from me, she may be the only real friend I have.
Chapter 34. Gigi. I'm in my room writing a history essay when there's a knock at the door. It's one of the RAs. I come bearing goodies, she says, lugging a huge box. Another care package from your mom. She hands it over. It's a box wrapped in a brown grocery bag painted in deep plum and turquoise florals. I love when your mom sends stuff, she says. It always brightens up the mailroom. She starts to walk off, but then turns around. Oh, and this too, she says, handing over a plain manila envelope. My name is scrawled across the front, but there's no return address. That's enough to set off the panic. My palms sweaty, my heart drumming a bit faster. So of course I open that one first. Inside are a stack of cut-up notes, ransom style. I recognize some of the handwriting. It's Alex. And I quickly figure out Bet's. They're love letters, filled with sweet nothings. He wrote, I'll love you forever and always. He wrote, we were meant to be. He wrote, you're my soulmate. I know she sent them. This has Bet written all over it. She's not even subtle anymore. And I know I shouldn't let it get to me, but it does. Because with the bits and pieces of their notes is another one, pieced together that says, you'll never have what we had. He will be mine again. And for some reason, I know she's right. I can't even compete. But this time, I'm furious, and I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to find the evidence. Everyone else is in morning ballet class. I don't have to go, so I can give my foot a rest and be ready for rehearsal tonight. My first one back. I walk the entire length of the hall to make sure no one is still lingering up here. I listen for voices, classical music, the soft padding of ballet slippers. Then I take one step after the other until I'm standing in front of Bet's door. I try the knob. It opens without a hitch. I'm surprised it isn't locked. Mama says my thrill in being in places where I'm not supposed to is a compulsion, and I shouldn't do it anymore. Light trickles through the white drapes on her window. I can tell which side of the room is Bet's and which is Eleanor's. Eleanor has motivational quotes and mantras scrawled all over the corkboard near her bed. Bet's side of the room has one of those expensive trunks you see in the store windows on Madison Avenue. Her desk is lined with trinkets, and she has a beautiful jewelry box chalk full of rings and bracelets and necklaces studded with diamonds. Pinned to her wall are a series of origami flowers, from Alec, no doubt. I feel a little pinch, feeling the fool for somehow believing that Alec had only made those for me. I hunt for the original letter she cut up. The little vanity in the corner smells like a mix of hairspray and expensive perfume and powder, like a makeup counter. There's a row of neatly lined up lipsticks, all fancy and expensive brands. I go through them, opening this one and that, inhaling the scent and absorbing the color before carefully recapping them. And there it is, the gaudy pink one with the indented top. The same lipstick that scrawled the mean message on the mirror that day. Buoyed by my first find, I continue my search. I comb through the desk drawers. Other findings come fast. A stash of stuff from Alec. Little mementos that she's kept in the file drawer of her desk. A Valentine's Day card from last year. Photos of them dancing and performances throughout the years. One from when they were maybe about 7. Cherubic and haloed. Their blonde heads and blue smiling eyes, like a match set. Then another one of them, around ages 10 or 11, filled out, but still quite startlingly similar, as if they could be siblings. But the next few shots would easily dispel any such notion. There they are doing their paw in Don Quixote, the joy clear on their faces, and then playing on the beach, Alec's arms around Beth's bikinied body, casual and relaxed and oh so intimate. I've seen evidence of much worse, but the image burns my eyes and my heart, further proof of how well they fit and how mismatched Alec and I really are. What am I thinking? What am I doing here? Why am I torturing myself? Why can't I trust that he likes me? I stash the photos back in the drawer and tiptoe toward the closet. I browse through the clothes, expensive dance wear and Beth's always fabulous dresses, all size 0, naturally. Along the floor are sky-high heels, couture goodies that probably cost as much as a year at the conservatory. I stroke the cashmere sweaters neatly stacked on the shelves, finding myself coveting, once again, what Beth has. I try to snap myself out of it. I should get out of here. But then, there's one more box. A pretty damask print, cardboard box on the floor that's calling my name. I can't not look. Kneeling down, I gingerly lift the top. Inside is a disorganized mess of paper. Meal and clothing receipts. Beth's signature scrawled across the bottom of many. I dig through them, and they lay out an itinerary of extravagances. Meals at the Russian Tea Room and Jean George. Her fancy frocks. The finest dancewear imported from Europe. And then, there it is. Completely out of place. $6 spent for 2 frosted cookies and a latte from the coffee shop around the corner. On Valentine's Day, 12:07 p.m. during our lunchtime. Irrefutable proof. As much as she denies it, it's been Beth all along. She's done it all. I stash the receipt in the back pocket of my jeans and put the lid back on the damask box. And just as I'm about to rise and leave, satisfied, I hear a voice. "What are you doing?" Eleanor asks, standing in the doorway, her face startled and a bit worried as she looks from the box to me. And then to the box again. I thought, but I don't know how to finish that sentence. There is no reasonable explanation. There's only me and my paranoia and the proof that's burning a hole in my pocket. "You shouldn't be in here," Eleanor says, but her face has softened and her voice is low, as if she won't tell my secret. She's all sweaty from class, and I wonder if it's over yet. "I just had to know," I say, my voice rising, the pitch guilty as I walk toward Eleanor and the door, as if I'm the one who's done all these things wrong. "I had to see for myself, and you know I was right." I find myself pulling the receipt out of my pocket, shoving it under her nose. "See? Here it is, Valentine's Day." Eleanor looks truly surprised and sincerely worried. "Where did you find that?" I point to the box. "There," I say, "with all of Beth's stuff. She's the one. She's been torturing me. All the little things and the big things." I can feel the tears slipping down my cheeks. 1, then 2, then an endless stream. "It's all her." I'm shaking now, and I'm so, so humiliated. But at least now I know. "Gigi," she says, "you can't tell anyone," I say, suddenly urgent. "I have to get out of here. I have to pull myself together. You can't tell Beth." "I won't tell anyone." She looks down at the receipt, and her face does a funny thing. between a startle and smirk. As she processes, she bites her bottom lip. Gigi, it was me. What? I say. She takes a deep breath. I did that. The cookie? Yeah. She shakes her head. And the roaches. It was disgusting, I say. Why? Bet, Liz, and even Will and I used to do stuff like that. It's embarrassing to even say out loud, and I'm sorry. The cookie was sitting on my desk for days. The roach trap was from the basement, she says. Her face is the color of strawberries. I got caught up in it all. I got a good roll, and I left the receipt in Bet's things. I should have thrown it out. I don't know. Why should I believe you? You're Bet's best friend. Why are you telling me this? I ask. She knits her hands in front of her. Honestly, I feel terrible about it. I wanted to tell you so many times. Apologize. It was childish. Why would you do that? Do you hate me or something? I say, breaking Mama's cardinal rule of not asking questions I don't necessarily want the answers to. A little part of me does, she admits, and I don't feel like it's a threat. We've just been here so long, worked so hard, and you, she grabs a new pair of tights and shoes. There's no excuse, really. I'm sorry. I won't do anything else again. She hugs me before I can answer. Please don't tell Mr. K, she says. I'll do whatever you want. Just don't tell him what I did. She squeezes me tighter. I don't push her away, but I don't hug her back either. I came looking for answers, and what I've found is even worse than I thought. If kind, sweet Eleanor could hate me, could do such awful things, then what might the others have in store for me?